So what the handout does is what it's becoming increasingly clear to me that I won't be able to do in class, which is go through all five of these examples. The point of the handout is to show that you have a fairly tight structural analog in these five cases. But let's see how much we can actually do in the class. I'm interested in the differences as well as the similarities, because it's interesting to see that the differences don't as matter as much as you might have thought. So the next case I want to consider is other mind skepticism. One point of this jump between these two examples is that external world skepticism is, for some people, I think, especially say in literature departments, is archetypal of the most boring and uninteresting. This is the kind of thing philosophers worry about, external. Who cares? You know, a kind of answer is, you know, nobody lives external world skepticism. You can say what you want, but you know, I throw this at always, he'll catch it, you know. But whether somebody really loves me, whether I could know they love me, that's a real, urgent, existential issue. I mean, that's an important kind of skepticism. So one point of this contrast is to take the case that can seem to people like the most philosophically, as it were, disconnected from life, and take the case which, you know, if you read any Shakespeare or Proust or Dostoevsky and have wept a tear reading any of those books, you know something about. And I'm not saying there are no differences between these cases. I think it's true that this one can grip one, some people perhaps, in a way this one can't. And I think there's probably something right about the thought that it's possible to live skepticism of other minds to a degree that it's not clear what it would be to live skepticism about the external world in its Cartesian form. It's very important that the ancient skeptic about the external world, for instance, not doubt the existence of his body, as Descartes does. So. But Cartesian skepticism about the external world, it's not so clear what it would be to doubt it. The line, this, when the gap is between mind and world, as it is in Descartes, then it's not so easy to go doubt what's on the other side of the gap. But for all of those differences, and there are others, I'm not denying them, what I do want to try to show you is these two skeptical problems have the same form, I think, as well as the others we'll look at. And if that's right, if they do have the same form, this is a conditional claim right now, if that's right, then if one is insolvable, I think the other is insolvable. And if there's anything like a form of a solution for the one, it ought to at least represent the form of the solution to the other. So there's a reason not to simply, as it were, focus one's attention in philosophy too myopically. One's worried about this kind of problem. Especially because a lot has been written about this problem. This is the one that people have thought hardest about, for whatever reason. So it's worth noticing how deep its payoffs are, if you can figure out who you like on that topic. So how does skepticism about other minds work? Well, now the question is not, how can I know something outside of my mind, but how can I know someone else's mind? How can I know whether Dixon is happy or angry or sad, or asleep? How can I really know? And so, again, the question here, notice, doesn't have the form of how can I know what's going on outside of my mind in the world of the body. But the problem here has the form of how can I know what's going on inside someone's body, namely in their mind. So, the Cartesian skeptic about perception has got a gap where he's on the mind side. He's trying to get over to the bodily world, the physical world, and know whether things really are as they seem to be in his mind. The skeptic about other minds, if you have a problem about skepticism of other minds, we'll start looking at one, but the shape of it is one in which I have a body. That's not the problem. The body is the thing I'm looking at. The problem is, how can I know what's going on with that person's mind? So, in the first kind of skepticism, the screen, or the veil, is a veil of ideas. And the second kind of skepticism, the veil or the screen, is the body. The body seems to get in the way. I can see Alois's body. But what is he really thinking? Is he thinking, this is a really boring lecture? Is he thinking really interesting? You can't tell from that face. All I can see is the face. I can't really tell. If the face is in the way, the thought is back there behind it. I can't reach it. So now I'm looking on the body side, trying to get to the mind. So the structure of things on either side of the gap have something similar. But my position with respect to the gap has reversed. That doesn't make it any less Cartesian. I'm sorry, you had your hand up a while ago.
Well, I want to say that the mind outside of my mind is also part of external world, of my external world, so it's anyhow very linked to the first problem.
If you're a skeptic, I'm just saying, here's another problem. Let's start again. Let's look at this problem. I agree. If you're a skeptic about the external world, then you have a problem about whether I have a body, let alone you, there's a body over there. So I agree, you're not going to get to this problem if you have this problem. That's not the point. The point is, let's pick up another philosophical problem somewhere else and look at it. What is the relationship between its structure and the structure of this problem? And see how their structure is similar.
Another label, another philosophical problem, that's just a term, you know, it seems to be quite the same. Right?
The person in the literature department who thinks skepticism about the external world is really boring. Of course there are other people. Of course there are bodies. That's not a problem. That person thinks, but here's a problem. I'm in love with Dixon. I want to know if Dixon loves me. That's a problem. I could never know that. I couldn't know it. I know he tells me he loves me. But, you know, that's what boys his age do. You know, you can't. That's not, you know, that's, he could be acting just the way he's acting. And still it could turn out. He doesn't really love me. That person thinks this is a boring problem. That person I'm postulating thinks he has a completely new problem. And all I'm saying is that problem has the same form. I agree with your point. If that person thinks this is a real problem, then they're too worried about Dixon's body to go beyond his body. That's one reason why you don't really have the problem of other minds in Descartes. You know, I mean, it doesn't. There's people try to find it in one sentence, but it's not really a live problem for Descartes. Descartes' meditations are set up around this problem, and if you're working this problem, in a sense, it gets in the way of this one. I'm not denying that, but that will be true for a number of these things. We'll have a very interesting version of that point that you're making when we look at these two problems and compare them. This problem gets in the way of this problem also. But the point is to notice how philosophers who think that that's a really boring area of philosophy, I do the important stuff, are working on problems that have the same form. That's the thing I want to point out now. You're right, the guy who works over here will have a particular argument about why his is more important, but then doesn't change my point. Okay, so now, let's get a case of undermined skepticism off the ground. The classic case is something like the hand or the envelope of the dressing gown in philosophy of perception. In this kind of skepticism, the classic case is pain. And I think, again, one could ask the question, why pain? In literature, love is the great case, but there's all kinds of reasons why you don't choose love as a classroom case. You know? Which we won't get into now. So pain tends to be the classic case. So let's say Richard is engaging in spectacular display of pain behavior. He is flailing around, grimacing. His face is writhing with agony. Beads of sweat on his brow. I want to rush to his defense. I say, he's in pain. You're a skeptic about other minds, and a rather immoral one at that. Now, what do you say if you want to get me worried about this? What's the structure of what you have? Oh, we forgot to answer your other question, didn't we? About dreaming. In the other cases. Well, we can talk about that. But there's the bent stick. There's the cardboard cutout, there's the trompe l'oeil painting, there's all sorts of things besides dreams. But the case always is going to be one where if you're in that situation, you can't tell it from the real case. So here again, there's many kinds of scenarios, but what kind of a thing do I have to say in order to get my claim that I know Richard's in pain? Again, why pain? I mean, pain, we need something, again, that has the structure of a best case. If I said, you know, right now, I think Richard is thinking about his grandmother. I think, you know, I've known Richard for a while. And when he gets bored, you know, his thoughts drift to his grandmother, who he really misses. She lives way off in northern Norway. He hasn't seen her. If I turn out to be wrong about that, then it's a little bit like the bird at 50 feet. The conclusion is, he wasn't thinking about his grandmother. That's the conclusion. The conclusion is not, we never knew and know what another person thinks. So the point of somebody flailing around is that it has to be a case of behavior such that if we can't say we know in that case, it can set up the next feature of the form of Cartesian skepticism we're outlining, where the skeptic can put us in a position where we can say, if we don't know this, then we never can claim to know what somebody is really thinking, feeling, saying. So he's flailing around in pain. Now, what does the skeptic need? What kind of case does he need in order to overthrow it? He needs a case, yes, where what he's doing is
just making it seem like in first example, trying to establish an argument of indistinguishability.
Exactly. We need a version of the argument from illusion. So he needs to give us a case where now we have to say something like, Richard's bodily behavior could be just as it is. The outside, what's going on the outside now? Outside, inside, still. What's going on in the outside is just as it appears to me. But on the inside, things are different. Before it was, on the inside, things were the same in both cases. But on the outside, I was in bed in case one, and in the classroom in case two. Here, things on the outside are the same. But on the inside, case one, pain. Case two, something else. That's the structure of what he has to do. And there are many ways to do this. But the classic way is to say, for instance, Richard is pretending. Or if you like to elaborate the example, Richard is a very good actor. And what's more, he likes to fool professors. If someone is pretending to do X, and he's good at pretending to do X, then again, there are no marks or features that conclusively distinguish a case of someone pretending to be in state X from their being in state X. You might be able to tell, but there isn't any systematic mark or feature such that it is the mark of sincerity, any more than there's some mark that an experience bears that is the mark of reality. So just like you can get a really good product and it says made in the USA, you know, it's good. You can't look at your experience and go, this one has the mark of reality. There is no mark of reality. And there is no mark of the authenticity of human behavior, either.
My argument was, if this problem would not exist, art would lose a lot of sense because we would never go to theater if you know that.
Yeah, I agree.
If
external world skepticism is your problem, you don't get to other problems. You're really stuck. But the point, of course, of the external world skeptic, just to be clear about this, the interesting external world skeptic doesn't conclude just that there is no external world. Therefore, blah, 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 as you're saying. The external world skeptic's point is you can't know there's an external world. There might well be. But you're not in a position to know it. And the even more interesting external world skeptic isn't even someone who's drawing a conclusion about something, some large thing called the external world. The interesting external world skeptic, I think, is actually someone who's drawing the following conclusion. For any claim based on sensory knowledge, any claim based on sensory experience, it never amounts to knowledge. He might agree that 99% of them are true, but no single one of them is a claim to knowledge. And if that's his point, then there's a reason to go into the other thing, because he's not, in a sense, doubting existence.
Yeah.
What he's doubting is your ability to know a claim that turns on a claim about existence.
Well, okay. I didn't think, you know, I'm not sure if you understood me. Maybe I wasn't clear. What I want to tell is that what you're calling the problem is the let's call the dialectical space, as you used the phrase, that gives human relationship meaning. So what you call a problem, I would call a sense of everything. And I was claiming that if the problem would not exist, things like theater performances would have no sense.
Oh, well, I agree, but the skeptic is not saying that other people don't have feelings.
No, I didn't say that either.
Right. I mean, I do think there's a way to push your worry so that it'll turn into the version of the problem of other minds that we'll talk about next class. And then there will be a point to saying, then theater performances won't exist. But I don't think we're quite there yet. But maybe when we have the perspective of some other forms of skepticism, we could come back to this issue. So, this kind of skeptic, again, starts with a claim to knowledge. He gives us a best case of knowing what's on someone's mind or in someone's mind. The skeptic raises a question about whether he can distinguish this case from a case that is, if you will, a ringer. A case that's just like this case, but you couldn't tell it apart. It's a bit of American slang. If you can't exclude that case, it looks like you can't say you know he's in pain. I have no way of excluding the possibility that he's pretending. If I can't exclude the possibility he's pretending or he's acting here, then how can I ever know what's going on in somebody? So, we notice some differences. In the first case, we start with the mind, we know something about the world. In the second case, we start with someone's body, and we want to know about their mind. But notice the similarity in structure. In both cases, there's a claim to knowledge, you enter a best case, a certain kind of problem is posed through a structurally similar example. In both cases, it looks like I need an inference to have knowledge. In the one case, I infer from how things appear in my experience to how things are in the world. The second case, I infer from how things appear to be with you based on your behavior to how things are with you. I want to infer from something to something. In both cases, it looks like the inference is blocked by not being able to distinguish my basis from an inference from another case that doesn't yield that conclusion, but I can't tell them apart. So I don't know whether I'm in the right situation to infer or not, to detach the consequent. So we have all of those similarities. In both cases, then, there's a gap. In both cases, this is why I start with these two, because they have this much in common. There's a transition from mind to body, or inner world to outer world, might be a more precise way to put it. No, in the first case, we start with the inner world. We're trying to get to the outer world. Second case, we start with a certain neighborhood of the outer world, the human body. The human body here is understood in a certain way. The human body, whether we're a Cartesian or not, we're still understanding the human body in implicitly Cartesian terms in the following sense. We're understanding the human body as a certain region of res extensa, that is. The human body is here understood as neutral, psychologically inert matter. You know, it moves around. And then conclusions about people's mental states are inferences based on that. Any claim about what someone is thinking or feeling is adding something to what their body is doing. Just like in the first case, we're taking experiences to be ontologically neutral. They merely appear to be of such and such. And then whether things actually are that way is a further fact that blankly obtains over and above the experience. In both cases, there's been a separation of the element that's in the mind from the element that's been in the world. And we need to hook them up. That's the structure of the gap in both cases. And in both cases, the skeptic then says, if you want to structure the gap this way, it looks like there's a problem about getting to the other side. Very similar kind of problem. There's other things we could say about the similarities between the problems, but I save those for later class, so we can just at least peek at some other examples. Let's look at philosophy of language now. Here's a form of skepticism about philosophy of language that people in philosophy departments, as far as I can tell, are no longer interested in at all. They're not interested. I'm about to give you a problem, the philosophy of language, that people in philosophy departments are no longer interested in. They have trouble noticing there's this problem. These two problems I just mentioned, the two Cartesian problems about perception and mind, lots of people in philosophy departments are talking about. There's journal articles. This should have sounded familiar to some of you. But a different kind of skeptical problem has taken over in philosophy of language. So people don't notice the one I'm about to discuss. As if it didn't exist. But it's just as possible as a problem. And indeed, I think people in literature departments are worried about it. The problem has to do, again, in this case, the question was, I know how things seem to be. Are they really that way? I understand what the appearance is. But is the appearance truthfully representing the world? I understand that his behavior looks like pain behavior, but is he really in pain? Is his behavior, as it were, accurately representing, authentically expressing his inner state? So here we want a problem of that form again. The problem is, I know what this text seems to mean, or I know what this sign, I think this sign ought to mean, but am I right? Does it really mean that? The way this comes up in literature departments is, you have an interpretation of the text, and someone will say, well, sure, it looks like that's what it means, but how can we be sure that's what Shakespeare really meant? Or how can we be sure that? And there's all kinds of ways to get this worry. Some people start worrying about original editions, some people start worrying about alternative interpretations, some people just say with Derrida, another interpretation is always possible. So it has the form of the Cartesian worry, but you don't even bother to fill it in, you just say that. But so there's the possibility of the alternative interpretation. You can't exclude the alternative interpretation. So you know I'm right. So let's take a straightforward example. Let's say there's a sign. Sign says, let's put an arrow on the sign. Sign like this. Shape like this. And it says, Trondheim. So, I'm in my car. I've always wanted to visit Trondheim. Here there's a wonderful cathedral there. I come to this sign. I turn right. I'm about to turn right. My wife says, I've heard that things are different in Norway. And that Norwegians naturally respond to such a sign by thinking, you should go that way. Of course that would mean this. Or a more realistic example is you're in Greece and you ask somebody, is that the way to Trondheim? And they go like this. You think, oh yes, it is. But he's just giving you the Greek gesture for no. Might have been a little clearer if he went like this. But he doesn't do that, unfortunately. He just shakes his head up and down. So there's a gesture or a sign. Seems like a perfectly natural way of interpreting it. And then I say, but, there are occasions in which exactly the same gesture or exactly the same physical object or exactly the same string of words, must be a nice example of this, across languages, mean different things. So, the words themselves, the objects themselves, the bodily movement itself needs to be interpreted to be understood. You have the object, but now you need an interpretation. An understanding, again, we have two parts. A physical part, part that's just in the natural world, an inscription, a bodily movement, a geometrical shape, and something the mind has to contribute. A grasp, an understanding, an interpretation. You combine those two things, and then you have meaning. You have an understanding of the meaning. But the skeptic, this is the strategy in this kind of skepticism about meaning, can always construct a situation where he says, things could be exactly the same as they are here, but the actual, the correct interpretation in this circumstance is different from the one that you otherwise would have, or you have natural. So across two contexts, same sign, same meaning, same sign, same shape, different meaning. So now how do you know from within your interpretive construction? Now the inside is not the inside of my sensory experience, but it's inside my, if you're Gadamer, you'll say, horizon of interpretation. How can I know? I can't get outside my interpretation. How can I know that I have interpreted the sign correctly? Just one second. The case that you get most often about this, now in recent analytic philosophy, but it's usually quickly turned to something else, but if you want to make it a Cartesian case, it, nowadays is the number following case. You have, 2, 4, 6, 8. And then we go to 1,000. And then the question is, what next? Well, 1,002 seems like a natural thing to say. But this part could be the same. So we have it the same coming in a different way here now, in a more complicated way. But notice the structure is still the same. It's just a more convoluted example for various reasons that are important. So there's a part that's the same, and then there's a continuation. And all you have as your basis is this. And then you need to add something to it to understand this as giving you something that, in this case, means a series. But so again, there's many different kinds of examples of this sort of philosophy language. The more naive cases are cases where you just have, something like a gesture or a word, which can be interpreted more than one. It can, as Derrida says, always susceptible of another interpretation. You can get more complicated cases, but they still will have this structure. Yes?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Paul or Lau mentioned it. I think when you take the example of Saint Paul,
yes,
in dealing with the variety of skepticism, I don't think you can exclude the issue of time.
Well, why am I excluding it? All I'm saying is, I want to turn right. My wife said, the skeptic says, but, well, I understand why you think that, but you could be wrong. And now I want to say, I know I'm supposed to turn right. I know this means that. This, I want to say something in the form, this means that. This is something physically describable as a shape, a set of words, a gesture. That is something that's semantically articulated. It involves correctness and incorrectness in the light of this understanding. I do this rather than that. It's just an object in the world. I don't have to do anything. It's a signpost I'm trying to drive. There's a correct and an incorrect understanding. So here we just have an object in the world. Here we have something in the light of which I can act correctly or incorrectly. And I want to make a meaning claim. I want to say, this object in the world should be understood this way, such this is the correct action in the light of it. This is the incorrect one. This is the correct inference, this is the incorrect. And I want to say something that has the form, I know this means that. And the point is, the skeptic can always say, give me an example of a this, which so described is exactly like my this. But in the case he gives me, it means something else. And then how am I going to say, but still I know. I know this must mean that. And it looks like if I accept this description of the problem, then I have a problem of the same form that I have here and here. That's the point.
You know what I was saying, that when you take the example of standpoint,
yes.
Imagine maybe you stay, I don't know, maybe in Chicago or somewhere, and you're always driving along the road every
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm. And then I say
so
to you,
going to travel back after 2 months.
Okay, but
and
you know,
you find the same person on the road.
Right, but yes, you should have listened to the news. Yesterday there was a special show, and they said, "We're changing the rules. From now on, people who drive in the right have to drive in the left. The driver's age limit for driving license is now 21 instead of 18. And the signposts that point this way now mean that way, because there's been some confusion about this. There was this guy Dixon who was having trouble wondering about it. So we just made a new rule. It's harder for everyone else, but it's easier for Dixon. You should have watched the news. How are you going to rule, you know, you can't get rid of, if this can mean that in some situation, you're not going to be able to argue by the skeptic just by saying, it's the same point as before, enough quantity of time has passed. All the quantity of time will give you is probability. It's more likely. But the skeptic's not saying, you're right. Probably you're in a classroom. Probably he's in pain. I mean, Christ, look at him. Let's call the ambulance. But the skeptic's point isn't, what should we do? Should we call the ambulance? The skeptic's point is, can you claim to know? Now, I'm not saying time might not help here. As I said, I think Kant finds a way to use time to help in the argument against the Cartesian skeptic. But I don't think it can just be quantity of time. All quantity of time will give you is probability. And the skeptic's not saying, it's unlikely he's in pain. He's saying you can't know, because you can't exclude the Ringer case. And time isn't going to give you a way of excluding it, I don't think.
I have one small remark. I think this Italian example is the sign, it's the arrow. It's very likely to be, used under what Hume was saying by habit, because it is useful following this sign like you do it. And possibly, I don't know actually if there's any country in the world where the signs are used differently, but I don't think so.
Well, maybe not, but that doesn't...
It could be.
Right. It might be that no one made this particular gesture while they were in pain and failed to be in pain.
Yeah.
But that's a hard way to argue against the skeptic. I chose this example partly for naughty reasons. Let me just be honest with you. On Friday, we'll discuss a different kind of skepticism about language, in which Wittgenstein uses this example. Wittgenstein's point with this example is something totally different. It has nothing to do with the point I just made. I chose this example to make this point, just to show, partly when we go to the next point, how easily one can confuse different skeptical issues. So, in a sense, this looks like Wittgenstein's example. It depends what you think an example is. But if an example is discussing something for a certain philosophical purpose, then this isn't Wittgenstein's example, actually. But I chose it on purpose, precisely because I think, you know, what the issue is in philosophy of language gets confused. Wittgenstein's not worrying about a Cartesian issue in philosophy of language, as we'll see next time. So I had a kind of ulterior motive in choosing that example so I could go back to it. But I thought I'd better be clear about that, in case you think I mean to be explaining Wittgenstein's use of that. I don't.
Right.
I meant to be, in a sense, anticipating his example, so I can distinguish them. There's much more to say about this philosophy of language case, but I think what I'll do with my last few minutes is at least just mention these cases quickly, so we can start seeing, no, this can keep happening over and over again. We can have various forms of Cartesian skepticism. Cartesian skepticism is not forced, or is not somehow a product of directing your doubt at a particular philosophical topic. The external world, other minds. Meaning, you can get it over and over again. Cartesian skepticism is a form of philosophical worry, which you can get going in any area of philosophy. I would even claim that it's sort of constitutive of something's being an area of philosophy, that the different forms of skepticism, of which this is one, can be motivated in them. That's sort of a sign that you're... that the answers you're giving are answers to philosophical questions. But that's a big claim. I won't try to defend that right now. So, the problem of intentional action. Again, the trick here is to this problem can turn into the problem of other minds if we don't describe it carefully. There's a different problem here. The problem of other minds is, I have no doubt at all that Richard is, you know, expressing pain here. If I think he's pretending to be in pain, there's a sense in which I'm not doubting that the behavior signifies pain. My worry there is he really in pain? What's his state? He can only pretend to be in pain if he knows what pain behavior is. So, you know, having criteria for pain behavior won't help me because they'll apply to someone who's pretending. Otherwise, you couldn't understand the play on the stage. That's not our problem here. Our problem here is not distinguishing whether a certain mental state obtains, the pain itself behind the behavior. Here what we want to know is whether behavior is expressive of agency. So, I mean, a simple kind of example would be someone raises their hand. Mihail has been demonstrating this for several times. He's very good at that. But say suddenly, Mihail develops a condition in his arm. His hand goes up. Looks just like it did before. And I say, yes, next question. And he says, I'm sorry, I'm working on this. Peter Sellers is famous for making some gesture like this famous in one of his movies. So we have the case of this or this unobstructed. And we want to know, so we have a gesture, a human action. I mean, that's a case of a human action. There are all kinds of other human actions. You know, falling would be an interesting case to think about. You can let yourself fall. I say, you know, this is a very good thing to practice. Put down a carpet. You know, there's certain kind of wacky people in California who think you can really turn yourself into a better person by doing things like this. Put down a very soft carpet and everything. And then close your eyes. And just, yes, you're afraid. You have to overcome your fears. So let yourself fall. And then there's the case of somebody like me who just falls. Because I'm a philosophy professor. That's what we do sometimes. So what's the difference between the person who can just let themselves fall? Just like that. They've gotten really good at it. They've practiced it. They've reached level 7 spiritually, where they go down like a rock, not even apparently needing to think about it first. And the klutz, who goes down like a rock, because he's a klutz. Or the arm goes up. So the body does the same thing. You can make up your own example. But in one case, the person was acting. He was an agent. He intended to do it. It was a voluntary action, we say. It was expressive of his will. We have all kinds of ways of talking about this. And in order to be a human being, we might say things like, you must have a will. You must be able to form intentions and act on them. This thing can fall too, if I let go of it. But it can never intend to fall. It can raise its parts. You know, and sometimes if you have a bad cell phone, it just does for no reason. But it never intends to, I claim, about cell phones. You get to computers, we might get into more trouble. What's the difference? You can have a certain kind of skeptical say, you can never know that something's intentional action, let alone know what the intention is. You know, most, they're not, the skeptic, again, if we're clear about him, we'll make him interesting, make his position the philosophically most important starting point, isn't doubting for the moment that most human behavior is action on, acting on intentions. But what they are claiming is it could be mere physiological causes, or it could be mere unconscious psychological drives, like Peter Sellers, you know, deep and abiding obsession with a Führer, which means even though he doesn't want to raise his hand, he does. Whatever causal story you want to tell. But the cause of the action could be something beyond the agent's control. In both cases, you have something that happens in the world that's describable, an action. Part of the premise of Cartesian skepticism here, a very attractive premise it seems, is, well, the action is exactly the same, whether it's intended or not. One of the reasons I think that makes this premise particularly attractive in this case, which is why it's a useful case to look at, is because now they are temporally dislocated. In the case of the pain, our tendency is to think of the pain as behind the pain behavior, accompanying it at the same time. If you want to get really physiologically technical, you know, the brain is probably a second before the arm shoots out. But when we talk about it in philosophy, we tend to think the pain is happening now, behind. But the intention, you know, if I, if I do something, if I can form the intention well in advance of my doing it, and always, at any rate, some point in advance. We don't think of, or the philosophical picture that Cartesian has here is not one where the intention accompanies the action, but there's the intention and then there's the action. So the gap here is not just a physical gap, it's not just a gap between the physical and the mental, but it's also a gap between something mental at one point in time and something physical at another point in time. And so now it seems like, how could you get the intention? What's happening now is the same bodily behavior, and the thing you want isn't even here now. It was back there, and how can you tell if that's the cause or if something else is the cause? Probably, you know, usually, Mihail raises his hand, he means to raise. But how could you know that? So again, we have this form of Cartesian skepticism. I mention this because these problems in the philosophy of action, this is a huge area in analytic philosophy right now. There's much research on bodily moment, mental causation. Is this possible? It's a completely self-enclosed industry, like so often happens in the classroom. I think these problems are exactly the same form as these problems. As if you set it up so that the skeptical argument from illusion seems to control your description of the intention. The intention is utterly external to the action. Then you're either going to have a kind of realism about intention, which is going to look very vulnerable, because how could you ever really have access or know these intentions? They look like extremely slender posits that never really suffice to explain the phenomena, and they seem to compete with other explanations that seem by our explanatory standards to do better. Or you become a kind of anti-realist, and you're going to say, well, all the intention is. But the dialectic is exactly the same as here. Did discuss the art example. It's on the handout if you want to look at it. But again, I think you can get an issue that looks, I purposely, again, chose these two to get areas of philosophy where, as far as I can tell, the literature is completely insulated from these issues. But I think the issues have very similar structure. At least I don't see why the issue's not similar. I'd be interested to see if you can see it. So look through the handout, especially with the examples we did more carefully. I'd appreciate if you could try actually working through them yourself in the shower or the bathroom or while you're walking down the street. In a sense, you don't need much reading. You know, you just start with a body or a sign or a putative work of art and just see if you can generate a Cartesian skeptical problematic for these examples. And then next time we'll talk about a different kind of skepticism. And as time allows, we'll start to compare them. The end of next time and going on to Monday.